Hello, welcome once again to ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Paul Barclay. Today, governments should not censor the internet. That's the topic of the latest Intelligence Squared debate held last week in Sydney, and we have the highlights for you. The internet's revolutionised how you and I communicate. Your computer puts you in touch with almost anyone, anywhere, at any time, and in any kind of way. It transcends state boundaries and has few regulations. But is this a good thing? You might have heard the federal government is trialling an internet filter, which they say will help protect Australian families from pornography and violence. But what about freedom of choice? Speaking for the motion is Ross Lajeunesse, David Marr and Anthony Lowenstein. Speaking against is Kaiser Kuo, Alastair McGibbon and Elizabeth Hansley. And we begin with the first speaker for the motion that governments should not censor the internet, former Deputy Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor to Californian Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and current Head of Public Policy and Government Affairs for Google in Asia, Ross Lajeunesse.
Freedom of expression is a wonderful thing. My colleagues and I will argue that governments should not censor the internet. Today, 4 in 5 Australians have an internet service at home. The number of internet users around the world is almost 2 billion, and there are over 1 trillion web pages on the internet. The numbers are impressive and growing all the time. Now, the internet is not only vast, but it's dynamic. In fact, by the time I finish speaking, the internet will already look much different than it does right now, because in 9 minutes, 216 additional hours of video will be uploaded to YouTube. The world will write 500,000 new tweets, and 2.5 million words will be added to Blogger. So how did we get to this remarkable reality? The origins of the internet begin back in the 1960s when the United States funded research to build fault-tolerant and distributed computer networks. In other words, the internet was designed and built to span international borders and to avoid any single country's governance. By design, there are no country codes in IP addressing structures. There are no central governing bodies. The only thing that counts is which networks connect to which networks. And the internet was also designed to be open. And by open, I mean that anyone can upload content and communicate with other internet users. Again, there is no central controller nor curator. You don't need to ask permission to publish your opinions. You don't need to ask permission to read the opinions of others. You don't need permission to communicate with your fellow Australians or others around the world or to do research or to start a business online, as countless people have done. And therein lies the true power of the internet, the fact that you don't need anyone else's permission to use it or access it. To illustrate the open nature of the internet, I think about what doing schoolwork or research was like when I was a kid. I grew up in a very small town in the northeastern United States. And if I wanted to do a report or learn about Australia, for example, my options and opportunities for knowledge were pretty limited. You know, the first step would be I'd refer to the family set of the encyclopedia, which was already a couple years old by the time I went to it. And if I was lucky, there'd be 3 or 4 pages about Australia and maybe, you know, a couple black and white photos of very stereotypical things like surfers at Bondi Beach or maybe a koala bear or something like that. Beyond that, I could ask my mother to take me to the local library where perhaps the options were only slightly better. Or maybe I'd have a pen pal, if any of you remember what those were, where we would, you know, trade letters once a month and get something back. And that was pretty much it. I wouldn't have a very well-developed understanding of Australia. My learning and my understanding of the world in general were extremely limited. Now think of a child today. Now, within seconds, she has up-to-the-minute news reports from Australia. She can access the most current research and information on everything from this evening's budget speech to news archives of the Sydney Morning Herald, dating back to the 1800s. She can read essays and articles from Australia's thought and opinion leaders, some of whom are on this stage tonight. She can use Street View to drive through the streets of Sydney and see the city. And she can go to the websites of museums and actually see their collections. She can email Mr. Rudd directly and ask him why his government thinks an ISP filter is a good idea. And maybe she would hear back. She can access all of this information because the internet is open. There is no curator, no librarian, no gatekeeper, no one controlling who gets in and what they see, and that's the way it should be. Similarly, as a child, I think about my ability to speak to the world and how limited that was. If I had something to say, I could speak to my parents or my friends at school, and if I were really motivated, maybe I would write a letter to the editor. And maybe that editor would publish it if he or she deemed it appropriate. Now today, things are much different. My ideas, your ideas, anyone's ideas, are much more easily distributed. There are blogs, YouTube, any number of sites on which you can post commentary. And if those ideas are interesting enough, then they are seen by thousands, sometimes millions of people. And again, no one has to decide if my ideas or your ideas are good enough to be communicated. We don't need an editor or a TV producer, a media mogul, or a government official to decide if our ideas are good enough to get out to the rest of the world. The ideas themselves determine how powerful they are. Now, this global, distributed, and open structure sets the internet apart from every other media and communications network. It has triggered avalanches of innovation and economic growth. Skype, eBay, iTunes, Amazon, it has kept governments, it has kept institutions and companies accountable, and it enables people to break through barriers, from Barack Obama to Susan Boyle. Now, with these fundamental characteristics, the internet has evolved into a globe-spanning platform of communications, ideas, business information sharing, used by 1 in 4 people around the world and growing faster than any other form of communication ever has. And we would not have had this growth if governments had looked to control the internet at its inception. So not everyone is quite so positive about the liberating power of the internet or believes in such open access to information. Many governments find this openness and this easy access to information very threatening. What makes the internet so extremely powerful is exactly what makes it so dangerous in the eyes of some governments, especially those governments who have grown accustomed to controlling other forms of media and which now want to control the internet as well. So the battle is truly on. And if we're not careful, and if we don't push back against this worrying trend, we may end up with an internet which is much different than the one we currently enjoy today. We may end up with an internet that is a series of national walled gardens, where each is controlled by that nation's government with different rules, and in which each government decides which types of trees and plants get to live in that garden and which don't, where each plant is even carefully selected, placed and then pruned as necessary by that government/gardener, and where that government/gardener has the right and ability to keep the weeds out. I don't think that the majority of Australians believe that this is an internet that they want for their country or for the world. Thank you very much.
That was Ross Lajeunesse speaking for the motion that governments should not censor the internet. The first speaker against believes internet censorship is evil, but a necessary evil. Kaiser Kuo is a Beijing-based columnist and commentator on technology and politics. He's currently a consultant for international business and does media relations for Youku.com, China's leading internet video site. Kaiser Kuo.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I guess the plan was to get the irksome American accents out of the way as quickly as possible. Some of you may be assuming that because I live in China, I intend to be up here defending China's policies of internet censorship. I want to disabuse you of that notion immediately. I absolutely do not intend to defend China's policies of internet censorship. I am opposed to political internet censorship, particularly the way that it's practiced in China. I find it intrinsically objectionable, and I sincerely hope that one day we may live in a world that is free of political internet censorship. My instinct is to oppose curbs on those precious freedoms that we enjoy in societies, especially with long traditions of political freedom, freedom of expression, societies like Australia. Now, I am not familiar enough with CleanFeed, with the Rudd government's proposed mandatory internet filtering, to really take a stand on this, but I'm inclined to believe that, knowing myself well, if the debate were actually in fact about the proposals now on the books, I might find myself sitting on this side. But that is not what this debate is about. The proposal here is that governments should not censor the internet, not the Rudd government's proposed internet filtering law should not be passed. And for this debate, then, I am compelled to argue that not all governments ought to restrain or to refrain from internet censorship, not certainly in all instances. I hold that freedom of expression or of information is a value to which all people aspire. It's a desired end state, but the realities of history, the diverse historical experiences that all these peoples on Earth have had, it's handed people a very different set of values. It's constrained the way that we can move toward that end state without at least tearing the fabric of society. I accept, then, as anyone with any knowledge of history really certainly must, that we live in a world with widely disparate economic realities, habits of mind, political cultures, all rooted in history. History has conditioned the way that societies set their priorities, the roles that governments play. My position is, then, that internet censorship is an evil but a necessary evil. The reality is that in spite of what Ross Lajeunesse just tried to tell you, these optical cables cross borders. The servers and the routers live in sovereign territory. Nation states are not all the same, and nor will the laws that they create around the internet be the same. We cannot expect naively that they all will be. We must not think of the internet as something that simply sits above all the petty phrase of nation states. That's not reality. I think it can be reasonably argued that in countries with no tradition whatsoever of pluralistic politics, no tradition of civil society or a public sphere, no historical experience of political participation at the popular level, any kind of a sudden thrust toward Western political norms like democracy and freedom of speech can yield truly catastrophic results, turning people against these noble ideas. We really need no look no further than Afghanistan or Iran to see instances in which the perceived foisting of such values on people has resulted in something I think we would all agree is less than a perfect democratic idea. People cannot be changed overnight. These political cultures have inertia. They possess real inertia. The ideas that I so cherish that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights, they were themselves the expression of a political philosophy with very deep historical roots. They're the fruit of the European Enlightenment. They trace a lineage, a very long lineage, from political ideas that were gestating in England from the time of the Magna Carta, traditions of Anglo-jurisprudence with equally deep roots, of ideas that were very radical for their time, the ideas that animated the Protestant Reformation, of the rekindling of interest in classical antiquity that animated the Renaissance, and of course, of the very classical ideas of Athens itself. These are very, very deep, very, very distant ideas. The distilled essence of these traditions, the core ideas of the West's liberal democratic culture, are marvelous, they're unquestionably noble, and I personally hope that they do one day attain a kind of universality. But we must not forget that they are the product of a unique, exceptional historical experience. Time, technology, and size all really do matter. When, in 1791, the principle of freedom of speech was really enshrined for the first time in the First Amendment to the American Constitution, the world's information environment was radically different from what it is right now. How fast did information actually travel? At the speed of galloping horse. What were literacy rates back then, even in the most advanced nations on Earth? It was really still the preserve of a small, male, educated elite. Fast forward now to a country like China today, where there are 404 million internet users, twice that number of people who are carrying around with them in their pockets right now a device capable of sending text, a voice, even perhaps pictures or video around the country, around the world, nearly instantaneously. There is a lot more water behind the proverbial floodgates, as it were, than there was in the U.S. in 1791. And in this context, gradualism is a sensible approach. Censorship of the internet in China has, make no mistake, gotten worse in recent years. It's very arbitrary. It lacks transparency. And I think that there is no reasonable explanation for doing what they're doing. And I do believe, as so many other of my Chinese friends believe, that the internet must be considerably more free, must be considerably more liberated than it is. But I, again, like many of my Chinese friends, find that gradualism makes more sense than a sudden unleashing of the water behind the floodgates. China has never had a political culture where debate and open exchange of ideas were the norm. China's internet, however circumscribed, is now functioning as a de facto public sphere, and in its relatively short life has already palpably begun to transform the political landscape of China. The internet has been disruptive, not just technologically, but culturally, socially, and indeed politically. Rightly or wrongly, this disruption makes many Chinese people very nervous. That's true in large part because so many Chinese alive today have a vivid living memory of the horrors of the Cultural Revolution. The madness, the chaos, the lawlessness, and the abject violence. While we in the West chalk up that catastrophe typically to an excess of authoritarianism, an excess of totalitarianism, in fact, you ask Chinese about it, and they'll tell you that it was because of a lack of control, not a surfeit of it. Fear of chaos and desire for stability are very deep-rooted ideas in China. In America, I was brought up believing that, as Benjamin Franklin famously said, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. And yet, I fully understand, even while it frustrates me, why it would be that so many Chinese make that trade and make it happily. I understand why they would prioritize basic dignity and the historically unprecedented economic and personal liberties that they now enjoy over the higher order political liberties, these things that most people believe are to be had by the more developed countries. These are higher order liberties. China isn't the only country where the value of free speech online, even political speech, must be sometimes subordinated to realities. India's internet censorship is a much less well-known case than China's, and certainly far less onerous, but as a democracy with an essentially free press, India is an example that probably makes the case for the necessity of internet censorship more clear. Google famously pulled its internet search business out of China, in part because it could no longer stomach China's increasingly stringent censorship demands, but Google routinely bows to pressure from New Delhi when it comes to India. Its social network, Orkut, which is very popular in India, is routinely censored by Google. Much of this speech is political, but it's genuinely innocuous by American or Australian standards, and yet Google routinely censors it. Google's deputy legal counsel, Nicole Wong, told the Wall Street Journal, "In those gray areas, it is really hard. On the one hand, we do believe very strongly in political speech, and on the other, in India, they do riot and blow up buses." Thank you very much.
That was Kaiser Kuo talking about the Chinese and Indian experience of internet censorship. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, you're listening to an Intelligence Squared debate, Governments Should Not Censor the Internet, with me, Paul Barclay. Our second speaker for the motion is former presenter of Media Watch on ABC TV, David Marr. He spent the last 35 years reporting for Fairfax, broadcasting, mostly on the ABC, and writing books, his most recent being The Henson Case. David Marr.
Imagine the scene a year from now in the House of Representatives. It's question time. Kevin Rudd is the Prime Minister, because he will still be the Prime Minister. And let us suppose for a moment that Tony Abbott is still the Leader of the Opposition. And Tony Abbott unrolls a hideous screenshot of carnal action, right? The internet filter is all bedded down, it's all in place, all's there, the scheme is operating. And Tony Abbott comes into the House of Representatives, rolled up, and then unrolls with a flourish a screenshot of a hideous sexual act going on, and says to the Prime Minister, "How can you allow this on the internet? You have the power to stop it. The machinery is there. Why aren't you stopping it? How can you expose the community and children to this?" And he holds it up. And the Prime Minister will say, "Because it doesn't fall into the classification we're banning." And Tony Abbott will say, "Well, why isn't it banned? It's disgusting, and it's there because you are allowing it to be there." And he can come into the House day after day, week after week, with trashy screenshots taken from some of the most hideous areas of the internet, which are, in fact, lawfully screened, and he can say, "How is your government allowing this?" Because the minute you have the power to filter the internet, you are responsible for everything that is there. And you wonder, why would a government do this? Well, first, it's important to understand it's being done because Rudd wants it done. There are no freelancers in his cabinet. Stephen Conroy is doing what the Prime Minister wants him to do. This is something he will spend political capital on, and he is going to do it because it is about children, because it's about vulnerable children, and because in the handful of issues that really matter to Kevin Rudd, protecting vulnerable children is one of them. And that is because he was a vulnerable child. Decent people and decent governments do all they can to protect children. But they have to protect real children and offer real protection from real danger. The problem with the plans to mandatorily filter the internet is, though the children are real, undoubtedly real, the protection is illusory and the danger is exaggerated. It is suggested by the proponents of the filter that without the filter we are somehow defenceless. This is rubbish. At the time I was writing that little Henson book about the extraordinary panic that swept Australia at that time, I had the opportunity to meet and talk to the AFP officers who run the policing of the internet for things like child porn. And at exactly the time the Henson thing blew up, they were bringing in one of the most important operations they had done in suppressing and punishing those who deal in child porn. It was called Operation Centurion. It led to hundreds of arrests around the world and 50 or 60 arrests in Australia. It led to the rescue of children from bondage in Australia. It was a remarkable and a successful operation. The officers involved in Operation Centurion had to leave their work for a few days in order to look at the Hensons owned by the National Gallery in Canberra. The police were ropeable about this waste of their time, completely ropeable. Now, they work very well policing the internet. In New South Wales, if you are found to be making or disseminating or holding, possessing child pornography, you can go to jail for 10 years. Now, a charge involving child pornography does not just involve a jail sentence. The conviction on a charge of child pornography shreds your life. You have nothing remotely like a reputation left. The internet is policed for child pornography, and those who are caught are extremely strongly punished. We are not defenceless without a filter. We simply are not. I'm not sure that I would be here tonight if this was a plan by the government tightly focused on removing from the internet child pornography. I would perhaps be arguing that there's a danger with such plans, that having established the machinery to censor one thing on the internet, a government at some time further down the track might be tempted to censor more. The unique thing about the Australian plan is that bracket creep is built in. It is there from the start. This is not just about child pornography. It is about the whole category, which now has the rather unfortunately ambiguous initials RC. Now, there may be some people in this audience, roughly my age, who think RC refers to Roman Catholic. No, it is not. There is no plan here at the moment to ban the works of the Catholic Church. The RC stands for refused classification, and it is not a small category in this country. It is a very idiosyncratic category. And everything falling into RC, let's put to one side the hilarious proposition that the small team of people in Surrey Hills who make the classifications are going to be capable of classifying the whole of the world's internet. But what is proposed to be banned in this country will be, by the internet filtering, will be computer games for adults, which are banned in this country. We are a unique country, the world. We ban computer games for adults. Salo, that old film, has just recently been released, so it's not going to be banned. Anything about methods for euthanasia, of course, will be banned. And I could imagine at some stage Tony Abbott coming into the House of Representatives and saying, look, here's a picture of people... Oh, I was going to say smoking. No, because, of course, the Liberal Party took $200,000 from British American Tobacco and Philip Morris last year. So he wouldn't be... But maybe he would want, say, dope smoking banned by a filter. This is a tremendously bad idea. We can deal with this without the government taking the power to decide what we can and cannot see using secret lists to determine it. We can do it without that. And while we can do it without that, we must. There is no sense in us handing the government this kind of machinery with its impact on our lives.
David Marr. The second speaker against the motion is the former head of trust and safety at eBay Australia, founding director of the Australian High Tech Crime Centre, as well as founder of the Internet Safety Institute, Alastair McGibbon.
The internet is a reflection of society. It's a reflection of both the good and the bad. Just like in the offline world, online we find good and bad people. I think what shocks people most on the internet is that amongst all of the good things, amongst the creativity and the trade, amongst all of those things that we hold so dear about the internet, is just how much bad there can be as well. Ask any police officer working child sex crimes whether they're shocked and appalled and possibly even a little bit disheartened about the volume of child sex abuse they see occurring online. Are they disheartened by the huge number of child sex images that a child sex offender can amass online and the speed with which an offender will hone in on their potential victim for them to carry out their highly illegal sexual fantasies? Real children, real victims, and real danger. Ask any educator if they're now worried about the amount of cyberbullying that their students are partaking in. Real devastation caused by virtual harassment. But look, the internet is a reflection of what we're doing. It's not something over there. It's not something virtual. The internet is us. And the internet is what we do in business. The internet is what we do at home. And indeed, the number one way in which Australians now engage our government is online. Ladies and gentlemen, the debate tonight is whether the internet is some type of virtual utopia that needs to be carved off from the rest of society and sat on a pillar and protected against government and any form of social regulation, or it's a useful tool that we, flawed people, use that requires some form of social control, some form of predictability. I am defending the notion of the Australian government having some role in determining access to very tightly defined segments of information by Australians. But to argue that the Australian government has some role to play does not mean that the Australian government has a large role to play. In fact, I know that my fellow negative side would say that the individual has the largest role in determining what they do online and what they consume. but the government has some role. I should also add that it's improper to imply that because we say the government has some role in determining what we might be able to consume in terms of media, that we are supporters of the current Australian government proposal for clean feed. It would be improper and wrong. In fact, it would be a distortion of what this debate is about. I, for one, am not a supporter. It will not work. But I do believe in the right of governments to help determine some of the ways in which we can consume media. The basis of my argument is that the internet is not a gimmick. We talk about surfing the web like it's some holiday function that we do. The very name surfing implies it's recreational. We need to change that name or the word so that we can talk about the importance of this. Most of us run very important businesses and private lives now using the internet. We keep in touch with friends and family. We make new friends online. These things are important to us. So it's vital that the internet is robust. It's vital that we have a degree of predictability to it. And there are many reasons why we find this hard. Jurisdiction has already been mentioned by the other side. But the number one reason why it's hard is the concept of anonymity. The internet is one big psychological experiment for what psychologists called de-individuation. And that's where the situation allows you to somehow lose your social and ethical control around you. Your moral codes recede. And if you remember the social experiments of the 50s and 60s and 70s of whether people would electrocute people or torture people more if they weren't identified, welcome to the internet, where the anonymity allows people to do things that they may not otherwise do. So they don't quite feel that their actions have the same weight online. It's virtual. Tell that to a victim of crime online. The other side in this debate would have you think that the government is evil. Well, at least it's a bit malignant and its intentions aren't pure. So the government should vacate the field. Let's get the government out of there. Who's left? Corporations. Big corporations and small corporations online. Companies like Google. So we've already been told that there are a trillion pages on the internet, that there are 500 million words added in hours, and there are. Thousands of hours of YouTube will be added while we speak. Fantastic. No human being can sort it out. So the internet is not about whether there is information out there. The internet is now about finding that information, sequencing it, and serving it to us as individual consumers. That's where the real power lies. That's where the real power lies on the internet, and that power now lies with companies like Google. So what about Google and the way in which it indexes the world's information? Their actual stated aim is to organise the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. But as I said, our heads would explode. So instead, Google now chooses which information will survive and which information won't. If you're not top of the fold, your information will die. Who here goes past the fifth page in any Google search? Google determines now the information that we consume. No one elected them. They're largely offshore and beyond our laws. They have no FOI. They have a secret code that makes them tens of billions of dollars a year controlling that very information. Different to a government that we elect? Let me read you a quick list, put together by Reporters Without Borders. Borders Without Borders would be much better. Reporters Without Borders. China, Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Turkmenistan, Vietnam, Australia, and Yemen. Now, if I was sitting NAPLAN today and asked which was the odd one out, I would choose Australia. Let's not allow the fact that someone puts us on the list of axis of evil to be treated as if we somehow, Australians that we are somehow the same as those other governments. This debate is about whether or not the Australian government has a role in order to control some of the information we consume. Thank you.
The Internet is Us. Alastair McGibbon. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Paul Barclay, and you're listening to an Intelligence Squared debate recorded last week in Sydney. The motion before the House, that governments should not censor the internet. The final speaker for the motion is Anthony Lowenstein, a Sydney-based independent freelance journalist, author and blogger. He's author of a book on the Israel-Palestine conflict, My Israel Question, and is a board member of Macquarie University's Centre for Middle East and North African Studies, Anthony Lowenstein.
We live under the illusion that governments can protect us from the evils of the world. Pedophilia, extreme violence, lessons in self-harm, suicide, race, hate, terrorism. And we know since September 11, 2001, there's been an explosion of terror groups meeting and organising online to plan mass carnage. We seem helpless to stop it. We look to governments and security authorities to target the weak, the motivated and the deadly. We rarely seem to ask why growing numbers of Muslims hate us and want us dead. We have every right to expect governments to monitor hate and terror sites and arrest and prosecute those who aim to do us harm. But censoring the where will have no effect on insulating us from these horrors. It's a false security, comforting election-style rhetoric to convince fearful parents and scared teachers. And that's just in the West. Having spent time in numerous repressive states, such as Cuba, Egypt, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia and China, there is no indication, that these nations are any better at protecting their citizens from the darkest recesses of the internet or the mind. And millions of users find ways around these filtering services, often provided, I might add, by Western multinationals. Besides, tell me how trying to ban YouTube videos of men kissing or women driving, both illegal acts in the US-backed dictatorship of Saudi Arabia, proves anything other than officials will filter material that suits their political agenda. And who here this evening trusts our government of either political stripe to transparently, and that's the key point, only block content that is harmful to children? Already in Europe, there are debates about banning websites that allegedly endorse terrorism. But who makes this decision? Resistance movements that oppose American and Australian actions in Iraq and Afghanistan, elected Palestinian parties such as Hamas, which are backed by millions of Arabs in much of the world. The powerful Lebanese group Hezbollah, again regarded as a terrorist group by many in the West, but lionised across the Muslim world. We are not far in this country from a day when shrieking voices will advocate the filtering of political content that offends certain sensibilities, ethnic groups, racial minorities, or political parties. This does not mean it's good public policy designed to improve social harmony, because censorship, ladies and gentlemen, is always about a form of control. No society has complete freedom of speech, no one. But we should be very, very mindful of any government that tells us filtering will be painful or cost-free. Now, democracy doesn't arrive on the net. Never has, never will. This is a myth. It only comes through people power, with maybe the assistance of the internet. Government censorship merely reinforces the fear of change and shows citizens how afraid dictatorships are of true democracy and public engagement. If anything, it can harm democratic aspirations of the oppressed by giving unprecedented insight into people's private lives and movements. The internet is unlike any other medium. Books, films and art can be relatively easily banned. Mass distribution stopped with a flick of a pen. But websites, on the other hand, can move, they can evolve, they can reappear in a different space tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. They're interactive, or Web 2.0 is at least, and allow users to pick and choose their involvement. And of course, compared to that, TV and cinema is a one-way street, visually seductive, but incapable of conversing with the viewer, you and me. Now, respecting the intelligence of a parent to monitor a child's activities is seemingly beyond the capability of many Western states, including Norway, Finland, the UK, Denmark, the Netherlands and New Zealand, nations that have all blocked sites set to contain child pornography, but impacts on limiting access to the obscene material has been very minimal. Now, we on the affirmative don't oppose schools, teachers, parents implementing their own methods to protect children from harmful content. Who would? Now, let's look for a laugh, but also because it's very serious, at some classic overseas examples. The implementation of internet censorship in Iran is comical. Allow me to explain. Now, if you type the name of former American Vice President Dick Cheney into a search engine there, you'll be blocked from going any further. Dick is a supposedly sexual word, for repressed Iranian officials, but Richard Cheney is okay. Teen, oral, cock, Asian, and thousands of other words are often banned. Even singer Bruce Springsteen was inaccessible during my visit in 2007 because it contained the word teen. The word woman was also sometimes filtered and is to this day. Queer and wanker, they're fine, but thank God for that. But many gay and transgender sites are often blocked. Unsurprisingly, of course, enterprising individuals are designing software, often coming from the US and Western states, to help bypass these rules. The point being, you can have the most repressive internet censorship system in the world, Iran, China. It is having zero effect on blocking the content the advocates of a filter say should be blocked. Zero effect. The web is as powerful as its users, and influential as any of us want it to be. It's not infallible, it's not perfect, and any democracy should care what content is available. But for governments to be trusted to censor content, with the churches riding bareback alongside the ideological cousins, should worry us all. Don't let the fear-mongering get you down. Thank you.
Anthony Lowenstein. And finally, speaking against the motion, is Professor and Associate Dean of Law at Flinders University in Adelaide, Elizabeth Hansley. She's a specialist in media law as it affects children. She's also Vice President of the Australian Council on Children and the Media and a co-convener of the Harvard Australia Symposium on Media Use and Children's Wellbeing. Elizabeth Hansley.
The main point that we have been trying to develop on the negative side of this debate is not to defend any particular regime. So I would like you to put out of your mind all of the particular examples that you have heard tonight about Australia and overseas, and any particular thing that anyone has suggested might happen. We want you to think about the concept of government accepting a role, some role. Assume it will be an appropriate role. Can you really say there can be no appropriate role for the government in censoring the internet, in regulating the information to which people have access on the internet? Even my colleague here, David Marr, made it very clear that this already happens. It already happens because the police find people who have been posting material that is illegal on the internet. If there is material that is illegal on the internet and people are being arrested and locked up for having that material, that, my friends, is censorship. That is censorship. It's already happening. And even the speakers for the affirmative believe that that's a good thing. So what we're trying to argue here is that we should not dismiss censorship out of hand, that governments should not dismiss censorship out of hand. And in this sense, I hope you'll agree with me that the topic of this debate, that governments should not censor the internet, simply cannot be defended. Now, a lot of the debate about this tends to assume that what's to be censored, if we have any censorship, will be to do with sex and nudity. Maybe some of you have also had occasion to think about hate speech and what goes on the internet there. I don't want to spend terribly much time on either of those, other than to wonder whether Voltaire would have defended to the death the right of neo-Nazis to push their horrid hate speech, anti-gay speech, anti-Jewish speech and so on out to a huge community over the internet. Voltaire said that he would defend that of which he disapproved. He didn't say that he would defend that which tears at the fabric of society, that by which he's physically revolted, or that which put him in fear for his life. Surely we are mature enough in Australia to tell the difference between those things. Anyway, I'm not going to go on any more about hate speech or any of that. I'm going to talk about something that I've been doing a lot of research on in the last 5 years, which is food advertising to children. Now, I'm going to preface this by an observation that there aren't terribly many certainties in life, but I think one certainty is that I'm the only person on this stage who has spent 24 hours going on a trip to hell and back to bring another life into the world. Now, that doesn't make me any kind of saint, as you well know, but I believe that it gives one a different view on the value of life. And so I am speaking to you tonight as a mother, as well as an academic. And when I hear Benjamin Franklin trying to tell me that freedom is more important than health or safety or life, I want to ask him, well, how long on that day back in 1706 was your mother in labour? I wonder about Voltaire's mother too. And I'd like not to be writing a letter to her after he's defended those neo-Nazis' right to free speech to his own death. I don't want to suggest that Benjamin Franklin was wrong, because sometimes maybe freedom is more important than life. But I think there's a real arrogance in making a statement like that, where you assume that you've got the balance right forever and all time. That it would be folly to fall for an attractive aphorism like that that was made in another space and time, another place and time, to determine the level of protection that we provide to the most vulnerable people in our society, which is our children. And I'm very glad that David Marr raised the question of children, real dangers to real children, because that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the fact that, as you know, food companies have been under pressure to review the way that they advertise to children in recent years. And a couple of years ago, the ACCC made a finding against a food company in relation to a particular snack product and the way that they were marketing it. They were exaggerating the role of fruit in the production of this product, and that was held to be misleading in contravention of Section 52 of the Trade Practices Act. What did they do? Did they change the way that they used the word fruit in their advertising? Well, yeah, they did, but not in the way that you might expect. What they did was they developed a very sophisticated online world full of cute little characters, engaging characters with little biographies that children could identify with, all based on the product. And this online world had a name that began with the letters F-R-U. So they did change the way they used the word fruit. They took half of it and created an online world around it. Most importantly, this online world was full of games and activities where children could spend hours soaking up that marketing message for that product. So there's no longer any need to make any representations about fruit, because it's much more effective with children to make representations that a product is cool and fun, and to use their loyalty and to develop their loyalty by having them engaged in activities relating to the product for the longest possible time. Why is the internet such a bonanza for people who want to sell products to children? Well, I'll quote from the Kaiser Family Foundation's 2006 study, which tells us that the internet is a cost-effective way to deliver a brand message. While the cost to air a television commercial in 2004 ranged from approximately $7 to over $30 per 1,000 viewers, there are no media distribution costs once a website is created. Estimates suggest that when development costs are spread across game players, an ad for game can cost less than $2 per 1,000 users. So $30 per 1,000 users for a TV ad, $2 per 1,000 users for a website. You do the maths. Now, you might or might not agree that something needs to be done about food advertising to children, but before you make up your mind, just bear this in mind. Children under 5 have difficulty separating program content from advertising. Children under 8 have difficulty discerning the selling intent behind advertising and marketing messages. Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Hansley, our final speaker, against the motion at the Intelligence Squared debate that governments should not censor the internet. So now to the polls. Before the debate, 72.4% were for the motion, 15.3% against, and undecided was 12.3%. After the debate, the undecided vote changed to 5.5%, against rose to 24%, and for the motion, 70.5%. The motion was therefore carried. If you'd like to hear this again, leave a message, download today's Big Ideas or the debate in full, or perhaps even watch it, just head to our website, abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. Tomorrow at this time, it's The National Interest with Peter Mayers, tackling the big and growing issue of Australia's population. Peter will chair a public conversation at Melbourne's Federation Square between 5 commentators with very different views. Make sure you listen in. Thanks for joining me this evening. I'm Paul Barclay. Until next time, bye for now.